Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. We do have Dr. Young today as our guest. You recall from last week, she was scheduled to be on, but she had an illness, and as a result, she lost her voice, among other things, and was unable to be on the show, and I did probably a very poor imitation of her, and it was like two-way conversation that I tried to pull off. So today we have the real thing, the real person, and let me get right to introducing her. If you've been here for a while, you know her. Her name is Dr. Victoria Amy Young. She has been on the War Report many times over the 3.5 years that we've been on. She was also, for a while, an admin, the War Report. And we have a long in terms of the war and good history. Vicki, welcome to back to the War Report.
Thank you, James. And I thought you did a wonderful job being me last week.
I start to do your voice, but I said I won't go that far.
No. Hi, James. How are you? This is Vicki, but I'm sorry I can't talk right now.
I played with it for a while, but decided no, I will not do that to Vicki. So how are you feeling?
Much better, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to have a voice throughout the next hour.
Well, that's good. Well, then I won't waste any time here. Okay, last week, Vicki and I, in absentia, talked about JFK and his vision and mission for public education as early as 1961 through up to 1963, and how Lyndon Baines Johnson carried forth on his vision. And as a result of that, those two collaboration, we got from Johnson, who memorialized Kennedy's vision, and what was it, the ESEA, and Elementary Secondary School Act, ESEA. And it had a particular meaning, a particular philosophy of education. It also had deep, deep concerns about equality, inequality, and efforts to deal with poverty. It was an awesome bill, and the attempts to implement it were just as awesome. And what Vicki was saying last week was, basically, that's where we should go back to, was that bill. And then this week, trying to put everything in a context, totalitarianism, and again, how John F. Kennedy's words and vision are as apropos today as they were back in the 60s, given where we are social, politically, economically in America. Vicki, is that a pretty good framing of what you were trying to communicate last week and what we're going to do today?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I probably would add is actually a comment that one of the readers made on that article, saying to me, do not believe for a moment.
Which article? Which article?
The JFK one.
Okay.
He wrote, do not believe for a moment that those who've led us into the rabbit hole of test-based accountability aren't fully aware of the philosophy of JFK and its implications for their goals. So in other words, he's saying to me, do not proceed thinking that they don't know this, because I think, you know, when I first began this, that was my goal, is to try and help inform policymakers. But what he's saying to me is they already know it. They are choosing to ignore the philosophy that JFK eventually got put into law through the, you know, through, I give LBJ the credit for that because he is the president that signed it, but it was actually JFK's original advisors that brought the law to fruition. So anyway, that I wanted to add that one little piece in, because I think that's really important as you go forward, you know, trying to talk about and identify the people that have twisted that law into what it is now.
Well, for 3.5 years here on the War Report, I've always maintained that this, what is happening to us today, is an agenda being put into operation, carefully constructed, and meticulously implemented. When I talk about the Machiavellian agenda here, and when I use that example of, think of it this way, Machiavelli and Sun Tzu meet for dinner and wine on the battlefield of public education. We're talking about two giants of history, one going back over 2,000 years, another going back several hundred years. These were men who were incredibly intellectually gifted, and they knew exactly what they were doing when they were laying out their manifestos. The people that we're up against today, they have copied, or they have emulated, in my opinion, both of those gentlemen in terms of the cleverness, the sophistication, and the wherewithal, and the implementation has been phenomenal. But that's
it has. And you know, the one thing that you know, I think sometimes we fail to understand, and I guess I understand it because, you know, I'm one of those people that was educated in the public school system, in a school that most people that I graduated with probably call, you know, slightly mediocre, and that is the word I know they used in A Nation at Risk, but it happens to be the truth in my case. And really, politics, political science, political theory, none of those things were really of interest to me. So when we talk about Machiavellian agendas, you know, that's kind of a term that I wasn't real familiar with. And the way that, you know, I think it kind of solidified a little bit in my mind was when I worked on the Save Our Schools March. One of my compadres there kind of simplified for, you know, the term for me a little bit. And she put it this way: it's whatever it takes. So their agenda and their plan, they are doing regardless of the real consequences to our kids at the time in the school. It's whatever it takes. And I think that's a really, really horrible thing to do. I mean, No Child Left Behind was detrimental. We all know that. And if you had kids in school at the time like I did, I saw it coming down, you know, firsthand. To think that they're doing this, you know, regardless, and that they know it. And I'm really, really glad that I had a reader that pointed it out to me to not forget that they do know what they're doing.
Okay. Today's show on totalitarianism, you picked totalitarianism, and I would, and as I have already done many, many times, I would have gone with neoliberalism. And for those who may not know what totalitarianism is, and fascism and neoliberalism, let's give them either our definition, if we have different definitions, so that people know what we're talking about. when you say totalitarianism or corporate totalitarianism, exactly what are you talking about?
Well, I like the definition that Marianne Williamson put in, a little op-ed she had done, and she wrote that corporate totalitarianism means total control by corporate interests. And that's where, you know, they step all over my ESEA slant, because they have total control of that, and that became very evident as the Elementary and Secondary Education Act was reauthorized away from No Child Left Behind and into the Every Student Succeeds Act. They really had total control of that.
She also went a little further when she talked about totalitarian power or relating to a political regime based upon subordination of the individual to the state and strict control of all aspects of the life and productive capacity of a nation. That's where I thought you did a really masterful job in taking that definition and then weaving in the war on public education as a totalitarian phenomenon. I said, oh, let's go to something else, fascism. And the reason I'm bringing this up is that when during Trump's run for the presidency, different pontiffs and intellectuals were talking about totalitarianism, talking about fascism, and then dictatorship, the corporate state, you name it. And I think many people were confused as to what fascism versus totalitarianism is, and you just defined it in terms of the corporations getting total control. And
right.
Let me go back. Let me add World War II, Hitler, rise to power, Mussolini, El Duce, rise to power, Stalin, rise to power. We have, I think historically, the historians are saying that Hitler was more a fascist, Mussolini was a would-be puppeteer fascist, whereas Stalin was a dictator. And the distinction here, you've already made it in terms of totalitarianism is corporate-driven power for control.
Well, it definitely is in the case of what's going on in education reform. And you know, it's been hard to resist or fight against what has been happening because it's really hard to define the group of people that have come up with the agenda. But so you know, I look at those people because I had trouble with saying corporate, okay, because technically at one point in my life I was part of a family corporation. So when people would say corporations, it's not that all corporations are bad. You know, corporations served a purpose, and at one point, you know, they were to help as far as, you know, social goods and all of that. So it's not, you know, I think when we go lumping them all together, we really have a problem. But I really think that, like, your war report really does succinctly, if you listen to the introduction, I think it really does kind of narrow it down. These aren't all corporations, but these are corporate elites. And they have chosen the public agenda for public education. They exclude, of course, people, you know, us, the regular people on the ground. And, you know, when people talk about the grassroots movement, you know, that really was us. That was the parents, teachers that were on the ground seeing what was happening in the classroom because of the laws. And when they control the laws, they are taking total control of this system. Now, they can't control exactly what happens in the classroom, and that's what buffered our kids from the full effect of what they want to do. But now that they're moving, and this was always the plan, you know, to move to the technology-driven education, at least for the masses, you know, their own kids, of course, aren't going to get that. You know, they can afford something better. But once you get that total control of technology-driven education, we really don't know what is being taught. And I do think that's scary, and I do think, you know, I don't want to get on to scare people, but that is the reality of what we're facing. And I think people need to face that reality. Pediatricians are coming out with guidelines on use of technology, and I think that all parents in this country ought to be insisting that we follow the recommendations of pediatricians. And that in itself would cut out a lot of what's going on with what they're calling personalized learning, which isn't personalized when it doesn't, you know, really involve a person. It's what it's involving is these algorithms for kids, and they can call it personalized learning. So anyway, that's, you know, that's kind of a big picture thing. And like I said, I hate to scare people, but when you're looking at this totalitarian takeover of education, you know, I guess we have to remind people this is not just a United States problem. This is a global problem because the large corporations, of course, are global. So I think that should also be a real concern. And I think, you know, ultimately we have to get that control of our public education system, and we have to do it through the law.
I don't want to get too far ahead because there's just so much in the post that we're discussing now. But just for a moment, do I hear a note of optimism still, that the war isn't totally lost, and that we can
absolutely
still...
James, I'm always the optimist. No, I don't think it's totally lost, not at all.
Okay, I we may come back to that a little later on. the post, and I'm talking about the article on your blog, was for your blog, a long one, but you covered a lot of things there. And I would like, how's that for telling American English? I would like for you to carry us through each of the sections of that post and relate it back to JFK if you can. But the important thing is that I want to hit all the major points that you laid out so exquisitely in that post. Let me start you maybe jumping a little ahead of in terms of the total outline, but the one thing you did when you talked about to win the battle against totalitarianism, and you went back to the JFK piece the week before when he had talked about we need skill manpower, we need brain power to match the power of totalitarianism or totalitarian discipline. Carry us through that and then the rest of your article.
Okay, so you want relating JFK's vision to totalitarianism. And I think, you know, what we can look at, you can look at it through the law also. And I think this is one thing I would hope was going to come out on the JFK article is teacher preparation. That is most important for us to have control over the preparation of our teachers in some form. And I'm not saying that we should be telling teachers what to do in the classroom. I'm saying we should know who controls the development of our teachers. We didn't used to have to worry about that because it was publicly controlled. We had a public system, you know, publicly funded, publicly controlled, overseen by a public institution. We don't have that anymore. So we don't have control of teacher preparation. Now, when JFK's idea was we needed to improve the teacher workforce. In order to do that, he was saying that teachers don't have the money to specialize. So I can use my dad for an example here. He was a World War II vet, got his degree through the GI Bill, taught mathematics. When this whole thing, the Sputnik thing and everything came down and computers first came out, he spent a summer at Michigan State University, because that's the land-grant university there in Michigan, learning the Fortran language. He brought that back to Jackson, Michigan, where he was teaching. Now, I can't say that any one of his students, you know, went on to discover anything great. I don't know. But the thing is that that gave students all over the country the opportunity to do something with technology. And I think a lot of things probably went right with that program, because it wasn't that it was just at Michigan State. I'm pretty sure it was at every land-grant university throughout the country, because that is the system envisioned by JFK, that we would put that kind of system in place, that we could respond and create learning opportunities for our teachers, to create learning opportunities for our students. And then it wasn't done through private organizations where we have no idea what the curriculum is. And during the fight over the reauthorization of ESEA, I wrote a thing on leadership. I think a lot of people out there that have been following a lot of this, you know, they know about the Broad Foundation, Mark Tucker's organization, all these places that are, they're the ones with their neoliberal philosophy that are taking over the leadership instruction, which in turn is going to reflect on our teachers. So that's the kind of JFK vision that has been warped over time.
You state in the article, again, to win the battle against totalitarianism, it required skilled manpower and brain power to match the power of totalitarian discipline. And he was, if I get what I think you were suggesting, he was discussing education, as we are now, and to follow up on what you just said, in terms of who is shaping education, including teacher preparation, an example that was related to your site was the notion that, well, it's not the notion, the actual act, that the Koch brothers are sneaking into schools by buying their way into social studies.
Right.
And when, you know, when you do that, they are growing and controlling the next generation of education leaders. You just mentioned the word, ed leaders. They are actually, not just them, they're actually, and I said, none of this is by accident, people. And there are people who give the power elite, including the presidents that were their minions, that maybe they didn't know, they didn't understand, and that what we're seeing is the unintended consequences. I take a completely different stance. These are some, quote, the best and brightest. They knew exactly what they were doing and how they were going to do it and when they were going to do it, their timetable. And I've said this, I don't know how many times. It may have taken them 35 years to get to where they are now. But it's damn near total domination. And I've used the example over and over again. Christianity that saw total global domination for 2,000 years. The Crusades, you name it, sending Christians all around the world to try and turn the entire world to Christianity. never happened. The Muslim faith, same thing, never happened. These guys have done it in 35 years. Tell me if that's not awesome scary.
Well, I think it's scary, but that's, you know, and we do because we have been watching it unfold. And, you know, that's just not the case. I mean, people, and I totally understand that people don't have the time to do the kind of research, you know, like you and I have done. So I still don't think that enough people understand, you know, the gravity of the situation and how close we are actually coming. Because, you know, like when you talk about the Koch brothers and they're putting civics instruction, now they're actually stepping in on forming curriculum in the classroom. Now we are to that point where, obviously, and outright. And the thing that, you know, another thing that was pointed out to me on one of my blogs by a reader was this whole thing, and this is what I was saying about trying to pinpoint exactly what to call what is going on, because they've sold it as free market. You know, they use this idea that the government has a monopoly on schools. But one of the readers pointed out to me that this isn't free market. This isn't really free market philosophy, even though they say that's what, you know, they're doing. It really isn't, because they are controlling the law. So what he termed it instead of free market was a coerced market, in that, you know, it's this public-private partnership where government and corporations, and I'm reading his words, work hand-in-hand partnerships to violate our rights and actually provide us with less market choice. And I think that we see that, you know, if you can relate that to what happens in your small towns when a Walmart comes in, you end up driving out those small markets, and the, you know, what you have is what you get, what you're going to get at Walmart. And that is, you know, the Walmartization of public education. You've seen that, and it's true. Even though the Koch brothers and other organizations are, you know, libertarian philosophy and that kind of thing, I think they've all been duped. You know, this isn't really free market. This is public-sponsored privatization. And it's public-sponsored malpractice when they pushed high-stakes testing into the schools, because there is no, I mean, you look at the research, there is no good reason for us to use standardized tests on children every year. That came in, you know, that came in with No Child Left Behind, and it hasn't left.
We had a caller from North Carolina. Are you still there, caller?
Yes, I am.
Hello. Welcome to the War Report.
Hi.
And you are?
Thank you. This is Lynn Taylor, Common Core Diva.
Hello.
Did you say Common Core Diva?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay. And do you have a question?
Well, I just wanted to thank you guys for having this kind of call on, and I'm so glad that Dr. Young is talking about public-private partnerships, because I know she and I have traded lots of research together, and we've got all kinds of things, and I just wanted to let everybody know that if you have any sorts of questions, Victoria's a great resource. I know that I can answer questions as well. In fact, my article that's just coming out in a little bit is going to be talking about breaking down the Forbes list of all the richest people and all their influence into things that we had previously not connected to education.
All right.
Will you post that on the War Report so I can see it?
Sure, I can, yes. Mm-hmm.
Please do. That would aid me quite a bit in my research.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I've been researching quite a bit since 2009.
Wow. Vicki, you brought me some luck.
What's that?
I'm sorry?
You brought me some luck. your friend is calling in. She may not have ever called in if it was just me.
Right.
Well, you know, and it's really hard to have information, you know. And like I said, it's when we talk about it, it's not all corporations, but it's the corporations
right.
that are trying to interfere and form and control the public education laws. You know, they're doing it for their own benefit, and that's wrong. And that's what we need to stop. I mean, in my opinion and the opinion of a lot of other people out there, the current ESEA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, really needs to be stopped and gutted, at least. So, would you agree, Lynn?
Oh, absolutely. It needs to be repealed. And here's what we're finding out is that it doesn't matter what side of the political aisle you are from. This is not a one-party issue. This has been a plotted and planned public-private partnership shift in education for many, many years. And so when you've got the corporations who are forming these foundations for, you know, supposedly giving all their fortunes away, this is where a lot of this backdoor mess is coming in, is through these do-gooder foundations. And it's not that we don't need people doing good. That's not my point. But when they have to take everything and funnel it through this education reform funnel so that nothing in our world is free of it, that's wrong.
Yep. Well said, Lynn. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks. Okay, well, I'm going to let you guys get back to your talk. I'll make sure that I get that article out to you. And there'll be a follow-up soon that will tie it to the social-emotional learnings of ESSA and then the reform as well.
I'm going to do a series later in the summer that covers the
mm-hmm.
emotional learning and the whole ed tech juggernaut that is going on, proficiency.
Okay.
All that stuff. So maybe you will be
right.
interested in that, and you'll listen and or call in. Thank you for calling in.
Sure. And I've got plenty of research on that, too. So if you need it, just private message me, and I can get that to you.
Will do. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, Vicky, James,
can I pick up on my ESEA and social emotional learning piece just real quick.
Let me just say one thing before you go there. You were talking about things leaning towards a monopoly. I
mm-hmm.
said in my first year on the show that choice meant no choice and that choice meant one choice. And what people didn't realize, the neoliberal agenda, when it was being developed in Germany during the early 1930s, 1930s and the 1940s, one of the founding intellectuals of the movement, basically he stated that in order to remake things, we have to destroy things. And
mm-hmm.
here, the word destroy was considered too antagonistic. And so the word destroy was replaced with disrupt. It's necessary
yeah.
to disrupt. And then the notion, Milton Friedman, with the notion of school choice, getting rid of the public's monopoly on public education. What, if you know this history and you connect those two dots and third dot is our own personal experience over our lives. And we're seeing it right now, what I'm about to say, we're seeing it right now in the cell phone industry. When you have corporations warring with each other for dominance, what do? They seek to destroy each other and or they seek to buy one another up. So if you have four carriers, the two big ones buy up three and four, so now you still have only two big ones. You've eliminated your competition. You've eliminated public choice. And then it's those two giants battling it out for dominance. That's what Milton Friedman really was talking about when we say choice, that the public had a right for a choice. Well, you start off with 3 or 4 or 5, and then it's the last man standing. That's your only choice.
Right, and I think the term, you know, the neoliberalism, a neoliberal term, is another one that really is hard to clarify, and some people won't even acknowledge that it really is a real thing. But I happened to read a dissertation from a gentleman that did attend the National Institute for School Leadership that's led by Mark Tucker, and he ended up doing his PhD about that experience, and he kind of clarified it this way. He said neoliberalism is pro-business and does not view powerful corporate influence as problematic. In other words, there are still those people out there that believe they know best for our kids, and it's not a problem if they take control. And, you know, I think, you know, it's possible, I don't know, but it's possible that somebody like Bill Gates might actually, you know, and I do think he probably does think he's doing some good. But then again, I have that little voice out there telling me they know what you know. They know that JFK had a better way. It wasn't market-based. It was people-based. So, you know, it's really, I have a struggle with accusing people, you know, of being evil or not appearing like they would like. But, you know, you have to at this point say, hey, this is wrong. And if you want to do what's best for kids, we have to stop doing what we're doing. We know that the whole standardization thing didn't work. We just finished a 15-year experiment on it, and we've done that experiment before, and it didn't work. Same thing with school choice. We know, you know, the charters are not, they were not able to get accountability, that only 17% of them perform any better than the regular public schools, that it's really been a sell job. You know, they talk down the public school system. And like you said, disruptive innovation. They created a product, and that product are charter schools. Now, the voucher system is going to come in, and that's another big talk. So we'll have to get back to that sometime.
Well, let's go back to where we were before I interrupted you, and we had our caller, when you were going to carry us through the rest of your post and the ideas behind each of the sections.
Okay. And so which section would you like me to pick up on?
Well, productivity, captivity. So productive captivity.
The whole idea that, you know, when we're looking at the corporate totalitarianism and how they've taken over the whole idea of public schools. Okay, and so when they're turning it into their workforce development system, you know, and that, you know, I'm not just saying that, that is actually very real. You go back to 1965 when this law came into being, it came in under health, education, and welfare. You look now at Congress's committees, the House is education and workforce development, the Senate is health, they still have that in there, education, labor, and pensions. So we have done exactly what Mark Tucker's, and he was the consultant for National Governors Association when this whole thing started, or at least, you know, consulted with that meeting. And, you know, he runs education and the economy. And, you know, it's not a coincidence. This is all kind of coming together, you know, again, because they believe that these corporations can run our schools better than we can. So,
well,
and the people out here are beginning to, I mean, it's been such a long process of convincing us that our workforce isn't up to par. And, you know, there may be some underlying truth to that, but people have to remember this has been not just the No Child Left Behind era, but even before that, outcome-based education theory was put into the state before it was put into federal law. So we've had more than 20 years of this outcome-based, test-based education. So we've had plenty of time to, as some people would say, dumb down education. So it isn't really the fault of the schools. It's the fault of the theory that they've had to follow because of law.
Vicki, I would go back a lot further.
Mm-hmm.
From the very beginning, when Horace Mann was able to push through this notion of public education, even during his time, there were people from industry who wanted a seat at the table. They wanted to control what this purpose of public education was going to be all about. And they did not have the Jeffersonian idea that in order to have a democracy, you need a free and, he didn't use the word intellectual, but a learned populace.
Mm-hmm.
Who are able to, what we would say today, critical thinking, critical reasoning, critical assessment, that was the only way this thing called democracy was going to work. So from Jefferson's time to Horace Mann's time, we've had this push by industry to just get to the table. Now they own the whole damn thing. But
right, and I totally agree that they should have a seat at the table. You need to get feedback from industry for sure, but give us feedback. Don't control our laws.
I disagree with you there.
Well, that's what I said, but they should have a seat at the table.
Be at my table, period.
What was that?
I'm saying they would not be at my table. You're saying they should have a seat. I'm saying they shouldn't have a seat. I'm saying that the purpose of education should be the development of the youth, the children, the young, to be able to live in and be productive in today's world, a multicultural society, a multicultural global earth, to recognize and accept others, this notion of difference, the social justice sort of thing. Yes,
right.
I'm not ignorant as it relates to people have to have jobs. I mean, that's the capitalist economy. People have to have jobs. I'm certainly aware of that. And in order to be able to do jobs, you have to have some modicum of education and or training, and especially now in the technologically driven world. I'm not saying that you can't.
Right, and that's where I'm saying they need feedback. When you have people coming out of school, you know, that can't do basic math, and I know this is where I get in trouble with a lot of educators, but that is just the reality of working in private industry. I mean, I've been a veterinarian for 33 years. I used to be able to, and again, this has changed, and it varies depending on location, business, all of those things come into play. So when we generalize, you know, that's when we end up getting ourselves in trouble. But I'm just speaking from my experience. There used to be the day when I could say to one of my technicians, and again, I have good staff right now, so I'm not talking about the current situation. I've been doing it for 33 years. I used to be able to say, okay, this animal needs 2 tablets 3 times a day for so many days, and boom, I didn't have to do the math for them. I got to a point, and I do believe, you know, it was definitely in the middle of the No Child Left Behind era when we were getting new help in that could not do that simple math. So for one, you know, that is where certainly we train our staff to do specific things for our jobs, but we shouldn't have had to train them. And this is where industry was getting frustrated. I, you know, local industry here, I was hearing this from other people, where local industry was getting frustrated with having to do basic education. And so that's where, you know, when they come in with Common Core and we're doing all this fancy math, my first question to every one of these new fangled fads for math was, are they going to be able to add, subtract, multiply, and divide with confidence and check their work? So, see, that's, you know, that's where I do think they need feedback. When something starts to go wrong, it shouldn't be we have to wait for the trend in the scores to show it. They should have been able to get that feedback sooner from local people.
Let me piggyback on your math example, okay?
Uh-huh.
In California, and everyone knows I'm from California,
uh-huh,
there's a movement afoot there and in other schools where students are beginning to rebel against the math requirements, both for high school and for junior college, that they're requiring people to take math in a sequence, a series, that they will never use in their lifetime, regardless
mm-hmm.
of what kind of job they would have, and that having to take these math courses as prescribed by maybe industry, prescribed by the politicians, and et cetera, is causing so many students not to be able to complete the requirements necessary to go from high school to junior college and from junior college to their four-year colleges, so much so that the lawsuits are beginning to come out against this. Schools are beginning to rethink the math requirement. And my last comment is this, and I said this 40, 50 years ago. When you get out of school, most people will never use algebra.
Oh.
They will possibly use geometry, you know, parallel lines, perpendicular. It would have, no, you're not going to disagree because you're in medicine, and that may be it.
Right, we use algebra in medicine.
I'm a statistician. Well, put it this way. I was required to learn statistics when statistics first came to the social sciences, SPSS, Statistical Bachelor for Social Science, all right? And, yeah, I learned it because I had to, but basically, in my adult life, oh, I've never had to use the stuff that I had to learn. Now, so we can disagree. That's fine.
Yeah.
And we can disagree.
Yeah, and that's why I'm saying, you know, you do need that feedback. And that's where I come from. And that feedback has to be local curriculum. You know, that's where it should happen. Not happening at the state level or the federal level. Now, they can give suggestions. They should give input as far as, you know, research and that kind of thing. But when it comes to the local level, it needs to be a local curriculum. It can be based on, you know, guided by standards, but it can't be. The curriculum should not be so rigid, because that's what you were talking about when you were talking about being prepared for a citizenry. You know, you have to have that broad education. Yeah, you're not going to use everything. But when you're a young student, you don't know what you're going to end up learning. I certainly would have never, you know, I had no clue what I was going to do when I got out of high school. So I'm really, really glad I wasn't tracked, because I love my profession. and I'm glad that I had enough science background. And I happen to like science, so of course I was interested in that right from the beginning. But, you know, I had the opportunity. I had great basic education that I could build off of. And I think, you know, that's really where we've gotten ourselves into trouble. And we used to call them fads, you know. there were different fads that went in and out of teaching. Where now it really is a disruption of the learning process every time we're putting standards into place, and it's costing us, well, as Trump would say, hugely.
We're running close to our end time. I have a question that was just sent to me that I'm going to pose to you. And the question is, for the 21st century, who will protect students and teachers from the vultures profiting in education sector of our society?
Well, we're supposed to be protected by our laws. So I would highly advise people at this point, turn to the House, because the budget is going to be set, and like I said, we need to gut that law, and we need to do it right. There's only one real end solution to all of this, and that's altering the power relationships in this country. We have to take control of our government. That's our government. Our laws should not be controlled by the corporate elite, and we all know they are. However you want to label them or say it, you know, if somebody has some other way of saying it differently, great. But we have to take control. And we can't do that when they keep playing a shell game with the law. That's why ESEA needs to be gutted and clarified.
You remind me of something when you keep saying, it's our government, we need to take control. Lewis Powell, a guy who was nominated for Supreme Court by Nixon. Before he went on the court, he wrote this sort of a manifesto. And people who've been with me from the beginning, you know what I'm talking about. He wrote a manifesto, and he sent it out to the 1% and the corporation, IBM, Ford, Chrysler, Shell, you name it. And he said, this is our country. We need to take back our country, something like what Trump is saying today. And what he's referring to is that during the 60s, you had not only the civil rights movement, you had the women's movement, you had the ecology movement, the anti-war movement, you had the gay and lesbian rights movement. You had all of these movements, people gathering by the hundreds, by the thousands, what have you. And in the minds of many of the right, on the right, they saw this as a threat, of course, and that the people who were out there in the streets demonstrating that they were seeking to take the country from them, the lawful owners of the country. And in his memo, he was saying, we have the money, but we need to come together, stop competing against each other, use our money to take back our country. And they came together, and they used their money. But they didn't succeed in taking back the country. Then those people got together, and then they said, well, we need a political party. There's only two parties, Democrats and Republicans. They approached the Republicans, who were already in their camp. Boom. They had their money, their wealth, and they had the Republican Party. They didn't succeed in, quote, taking back the country and whatever it meant to them. Then they went to a third thing. We need a group that will go to the polls, off elections, national elections, and what have you. Bottom line, they went to Jerry Falwell and his moral majority. And when they did that, they were able to put together a coalition that actually went out and started taking back the country. So that's what you're sort of like talking about. Our time is almost up. Vicki, I'm going to say one thing that I want you to finish it. You were making a desperate call, a plea, to action, and but more importantly, to unity. Finish me off. Finish it off.
Well, I think like Lynn came on and said, this isn't right or left. This is a coalition of people, just regular grassroots people, coming up from the bottom and saying, this has to be stopped. Parents want to do what's best for their children. And that's something that this country needs to come together about. And education, you know, public education is certainly a fight worth fighting over, because it is being taken over, and there's no doubt about it now.
Okay. You heard it from the source itself. We need to stop fighting each other. We need to join forces in solidarity. And it's only then we will have the voice, the voting power, to actually get something done. And I've said this a million times. We have no money. But what's left of this democracy? Some of us still have the vote. And if we organize, if we come together and agree on what's important, and that we work for all of the elements that we think that are important, one for all and all for one, that is the only way we will have a chance. Other than that, I won't go any further. Other than that, my time is up. Vicki, thank you so very much. Hope to have you back on again soon.
All right. Thank you, James.
Okay. Well, folks, have a good rest of the Sunday. My Cleveland Cavaliers won. They stayed alive. I'm very happy. Have a good rest of the Sunday, everyone. Goodbye.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.